Turn, if you will, over to Jeremiah chapter 7, and we'll be looking at this passage in just a minute. Jeremiah chapter 7. As you're doing that, I'll tell you a little bit about something concerning history majors. History majors leave college with very grand ideas that those who do not study history are doomed to repeat the mistakes of history. But it doesn't take too long before people learn that the only thing we learn from history is that nobody learns from history. You start studying the history of mankind and we're making the same mistakes over and over again. And that's sad. But it's really sad when it comes to spiritual matters, because God has very great expectations concerning the study of history. In fact, if you begin looking at the Bible, you could say that the majority of it is history that's provided for our learning. And certainly the prophet Jeremiah understood that. For, counting today, 3 weeks, we've been looking at lessons from Shiloh. And as we have studied these, we've looked at procrastination, those people who originally met at Shiloh and wouldn't take the land, and the problems that we have just like them. We looked at the idea of turning the Ark of the Covenant into a good luck charm at Shiloh, the talisman that was brought out from that place, the tabernacle, to the battlefield, and what a disaster that was. And as we end this series today, we're going to look at the words of Jeremiah the prophet, where he says, you must learn those lessons. You must look back to the time of Shiloh and understand that the things that happened to them are the things that are going to happen to you now. It's interesting that it was very most likely that the ruins of Shiloh were still standing when Jeremiah spoke this. That the people of Israel may very well have walked by those ruins and seen this place and been reminded by Jeremiah. The reason that place is in ruins is because of their attitudes, and what happened to them is going to happen to you. He'll give a sermon on this that we're going to look at. And from that, I want us to make the application for ourselves, because the warnings that were given to the people of Jeremiah's day are the same warnings for today, because people don't change. And the same mistakes that were made then are the same mistakes we can fall to today. And so as we consider this sermon, let's begin actually with just a little bit of background on the matter. When we think about the children of Israel, we have to understand that their relationship to God was based on covenant. It was based on the idea that God had made an agreement with them. And you remember that agreement from Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 and 6. The Lord said, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be a treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the children of Israel." And you remember, Moses takes that deal to them and says, "Here is the covenant that God desires to make with you." And when the people hear it, they answer almost immediately, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." They were in full agreement. They liked the idea. We are going to be the chosen race. We are going to be the people of God. Now, you'll note that it's only after that covenant is made that God then extends the law to them. And within this law, he's saying, here is the result of that covenant. Here is my expectation for you. And you'll recall that that rested on the Ten Commandments, but not that alone. Because from the Ten Commandments came all of the other laws, everything related back to these. And within this covenant, within these laws, God said, "I want to teach you how to be holy. I want to teach you how to be a separate people. I want to show you how to be godly." And so in every law within the law of Moses that rested on that foundation of the Ten Commandments, God was saying, "Here is how you can become a holy people." But you and I well know the problem. You and I, from their history, understand that the people only liked one side of that covenant. They liked the idea that God would be their God. They didn't care so much for the idea that they would be His people in the sense that they would follow these laws in order to become more like Him. And thus the history of Israel is somewhat like a roller coaster with at times very high points and at times very low points, where they're getting so far removed from that covenant, where they're getting so far removed from the law and everything that that law was to teach them. And this idea of not accepting the covenant of God is the matter with which Jeremiah is dealing in his day. And thus we come to Jeremiah chapter 7, where he's going to give the sermon at the gate, we sometimes call it, where he's talking to the people of his day, and he's saying to them, you must understand what this means for you. And as he begins this sermon, he says to them, first of all, in a very optimistic tone, there is still time to change, there's still time to repent. Look down to verse 3. He says this, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place. Does that sound familiar? As Jeremiah begins this sermon, as he begins trying to bring the people back, he's saying to them, you've got the opportunity to be right with God. But there's a point that he makes almost immediately with that. He says, I want you to understand that this is not resting on the temple. Look at verse 4. After offering the invitation back, Jeremiah says, do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. He's saying, if you want to come back to God, it's coming back to God. It's not coming back to ritual. It's not coming back to habit. It's not coming back simply to resting your ideas on this structure. It's coming back to the covenant that God has offered His people since the days of Mount Sinai. And thus He says to them, if you come back, there's got to be evidence of that. There has got to be a change that's seen in the way that you're behaving. Continue on. Verse 5. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly execute justice with one another, if you do not oppress the sojourner, the fatherless, or the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own harm, then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land that I gave of old to your fathers forever. He says, if you come back, there are things that will point that out. Service to God is always measured in concrete terms, isn't it? We think about the spiritual side of it, for sure. But yet the spiritual side of salvation always has concrete outcomes. And he says, one of those is, I'm going to see you exercising justice. And he goes on to say, in again, one of the things that we tend to neglect to study in the covenant of God, I'm going to see kindness where you're treating others the way that you wish to be treated. That's not a New Testament idea. That's been around the whole time with God's people. And he also says, and this is the crux of it, you're going to show godliness. And thus you put all of this together as verse 7 indicates. What Jeremiah is saying is, if you come back to God, you come back to the covenant. If you come back to obedience to God, you come back to that idea that you will be His people because He is your God. And thus, Jeremiah says, there is hope. But he also says there is a problem. And that problem was in their current behavior. One of the things that we find really consistent through the book of Jeremiah is his strong language against the false teachers of the day. And one of the things he's saying about the people of this day is that they are following those false teachers. Look at verse 8. He says, behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Now, let's take that. Hold your place here. Go over just a page or so to chapter 8. And as you look at verse 11, listen to what those false teachers are saying. They say to the people, they have healed the wound of my people lightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. You see, those are the deceptive words. The problem is that they are ignoring the words of Jeremiah, the prophet of God, and instead they're turning to these false teachers who are saying God is going to do nothing, God is not bringing judgment, God is not bringing punishment. And that's why Jeremiah says there's a problem. But perhaps even more than that, he says the problem is you are not living like the people of God. You are not living in a covenant relationship with God. You are not following the law as He gave it to you. And thus, as we consider that, let's go back to the foundation. Let's go back to what everything in the law rested on, and we remember that in the Ten Commandments. Now, back in chapter 7, we read the verses earlier, down in verses 9, well, actually, backing up to verse 6, we started seeing what they're to do, how they're to live in the land, to take care of the people. And then in verse 9, he says this, "Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal and go after other gods that you have not known? And then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, only to go on doing all these abominations." Now, do you notice something that's a rather striking contrast? Listen to what they're doing, and then think about the Ten Commandments. God says, you've stolen. God says, you've killed. God says, you've committed adultery. God says, you've borne false witness against your neighbor. God says, you have made graven images. God says, you have had other gods before me. And I think by implication, the fact that they're coming to His house like nothing is wrong, we find that they've taken the name of the Lord in vain. Now let's take a look at that. Here are the people of God. Here are those who are supposed to be under covenant. Here are those who are obedient to the law because it's going to make them like God. And look at what they've done. They've broken almost every one of them. And thus Jeremiah says, here is our problem. Here is the difficulty. You come to this temple, but yet you don't come as the people of God in the fact that you are willing to be in that relationship with Him. And Jeremiah puts it in very strong words. He says, you have made God's house inhospitable to God. The very place that is to show that God is meeting with man, that God is in the midst of Israel, you've made that a place where God doesn't want to be. Look at verse 11. He says, has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I myself have seen it, declares the Lord. Look at the language that he uses. In perhaps the fullest sense of that verse, he says, you've made it into a robber's cave. And the idea the people would have understood behind that was this, that after robbers committed their treacherous act, they then ran and hid in a cave. And so what's he saying? He's saying that you, as the people of God, have gone out and you've committed all of these atrocities against the Lord, and then you run back to the temple. And you act like nothing's wrong, and here's your protection, and here's where you're going to be safe. And so he says to them, you have taken what is to be a holy symbol of the covenant, and you've turned it into nothing more than a bandit's hideout. And then he comes to the history lesson. And I want you to look and see what he says, beginning in verse 12. He says, go now to my place that was in Shiloh, where I made my name dwell at first, and see what I did to it because of the evil of my people. And now, because you have done all these things, declares the Lord, and when I spoke to you persistently, you did not listen, and when I called to you, you did not answer, therefore, I will do to the house that is called by my name, and in which you trust, and to the place that I gave to you and your fathers, as I did to Shiloh, and I will cast you out of my sight, as I cast out all of your kinsmen, all of the offspring of Ephraim. He makes a point here, that as you walk by those ruins of Shiloh, In those you see prophecy. You see what's coming because of your actions. Because the people of Jeremiah's day were a whole lot like the people of Shiloh. You remember the points we made last week about all of the wrongs in which they were involved? We said they had the wrong God there during the days of Samuel when they rejected the Word of God. They believed the ark was simply this good luck charm. For them, the ark was their God. You recall the text. It will save us. What had the people of Jeremiah's day done? They had turned the temple into their God. Here is the proof that we're saved. The temple is in our midst. The temple will save us. Same idea. We found that the wrong motive in the days of Shiloh was they believed ritual and spiritual were synonymous. That as long as you kept the ritual, you were a spiritual people. They hadn't changed much. Same thing in the days of Jeremiah. As long as we give the temple worship, we're okay. We recall that they had the wrong priest. In the days of Shiloh, it was Hophni and Phinehas who should have thrown themselves in front of that ark and said, "You will not carry this out." But they led it off into battle. Look over to Jeremiah chapter 26, and we'll see the wrong priest of his day. Chapter 26 is kind of finishing out the story for us with the sermon. We look at verse 11, and it says, "Then the priest and the prophet said to the officials and to all the people, 'This man deserves the sentence of death because he has prophesied against this city, as you have heard with your own ears.'" The priests are wanting to kill Jeremiah, the prophet of God. They're wanting to kill the one who was bringing truth to them. And we understand also they had the wrong zeal. You remember back in the days when they carried it off to the battle with the Philistines? The soldiers' cheer was so loud that it shook the earth. What do we find in the days of Jeremiah? He says, "Don't say, 'The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord.'" They were doing the same thing. Just as those priests thought that the ark would save them, the people of Jeremiah's day thought that the temple would save them. And what they had in common was this, that just as Shiloh was heading for destruction, so too was Jerusalem. God was saying, "This is what's going to happen to you." And thus that sermon comes to an end. And I want us to note here in chapter 26 the reaction that the people had. Look at verse 8. It says, "Jeremiah finished speaking all that the Lord had commanded him to speak to all the people. Then the priest and the prophets and all the people laid hold of him, saying, 'You shall die. Why have you prophesied in the name of the Lord, saying, "This house shall be like Shiloh, and the city shall be desolate without inhabitant"?" And all the people gathered around Jeremiah in the house of the Lord. When the officials of Judah heard these things, they came up from the king's house to the house of the Lord and took their seat in the entry of the new gate of the house of the Lord. And then the verse we read, where the priests and prophets are ready to kill him. Why? You ever wondered that when studying the book of Jeremiah? Why was it when Jeremiah was saying this temple's going to be destroyed, this city's going to be destroyed, you had the false prophet saying, "No, it's not"? Okay, maybe we can understand that. But what about when Nebuchadnezzar and the gang are at the gate and they're pressing in and the prophets say, "Oh, it's only going to be 2 years"? You ever wondered why? Well, here's the answer to that. Jeremiah challenged their ideology. He challenged everything that they falsely believed. Because remember, they only accepted half of the covenant. They accepted that God would be with them. They didn't so much accept the idea that they had to be His people. And what they would do is turn to Psalms like Psalm 46 and Psalm 48, where it says, "Though the mountains crumble, God's going to be with us. His city will be set on a hill." And they would take those things and they would apply them solely to the idea that God is going to be with us no matter what, and thus the false teaching. They could not reconcile the concept that destruction was coming with the concept that God is our God unconditionally. And because of that, the false teaching came. Perhaps this illustration will help us. You ever been to a bad, bad ball game for your team? And your team is down 49-0, and it's the fourth quarter, and you got 49 seconds left. And the cheerleaders are acting like you're 49 points ahead. You know, they're standing on the sidelines, rah-rahing, everything's great, smiling, happy. Why? Because they are trained to deceive. That's their job. That's to make you happy when you don't need to be happy. That's what false prophets were doing. They were saying, Jeremiah, you're wrong. We are going to survive. We are going to win. Nebuchadnezzar and the team might come in, but we're going to defeat them because God's with us. Jeremiah says, no, he's not. You remember the covenant that they broke at Shiloh? That's what you're breaking. And the same penalty for them will be for you. And I love his closing words. As he says in verse 12 to all the officials and the people saying, the Lord sent me to prophesy against this house and to all the words that you have heard. Now therefore mend your ways and your deeds and obey the voice of the Lord your God, and the Lord will relent of this disaster that he has pronounced against you. But as for me, behold, I am in your hands. Do with me what seems good and right to you. Only know for certain that if you put me to death, you will bring innocent blood upon yourselves and upon the city and its inhabitants. For in truth, the Lord sent me to you to speak all these words in your ears. Jeremiah says, kill me if you want to. What a hard life he lived. And what a sterling example he sets. But what he realized is that their spiritual vision had not been restored. What they needed to see was not there. And because of that, the ruins of the temple would one day be just as those at the ruins of Shiloh. Well, what a magnificent sermon. And we take this and we understand that there are so many lessons that Jeremiah tells us that we need to learn. But the very first one is that the problems didn't end at Shiloh or Jeremiah's Jerusalem. They didn't stop there. Because what we learn from history is that nobody learns from history. What we learn from the people of God is that they made the same mistakes over and over. And thus, it's no surprise that when we get to the point of Jesus making his earthly appearance, that the same trouble is there. Same problem, different characters, this time the Pharisees. You remember what Jesus said to them? He entered the temple and drove out all who sold and bought in the temple, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. He said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you make it a den of robbers. Does that sound familiar? He quotes Jeremiah. The same message Jeremiah brought to the Jews of his day is the same message Jesus brings to the Pharisees of his day. They had committed all manner of atrocities and then ran to the temple like their robber's cave. But maybe even a little bit more surprising than that is that the very apostles of Jesus had difficulty with this. You remember what said that kind of leads Jesus into a discussion of the temple's destruction? Mark chapter 13, he came out of the temple. One of his disciples said to him, look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings. I want to add to that Luke's account. And while some were speaking of the temple, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings. Lord, look at this beautiful building. Does that kind of sound to you like the temple of the Lord? The temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord. What does he say to them? As for these things that you see, the days will come when there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. The problem was there. In Jesus' day, with his enemies, with his allies. And that temple was destroyed, just as it was in the days of Jeremiah. Now, let's bring this down to a little bit more of a personal application for us. Because this is a warning to us. This is a warning to Christians. Because you see, the Jews aren't the only ones that have a covenant with God. They're not the only ones who had that Sinai covenant in its actual wording. We look at the book of Revelation here at the very end of the New Testament. John writes, "I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be His people, and God Himself will be with them as their God.'" Same covenant. The Jews failed. God said, "I'm not done. I am going to have a people who obey me to be like me because they love me." And you and I are those people. We're the people Jeremiah himself prophesied about. When there will come a time when it will be the heart on which the law is written. And so we must be very careful that we don't fall into the same dilemma that they fell into. Because God gives us ample warning that it can happen. You remember the church at Sardis on the other end of the book of Revelation? They had a Shiloh problem, didn't they? "I know your works. You have a reputation of being alive, but you're dead. Wake up, strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have not found your works complete in the sight of my God. Remember then what you received and heard. Keep it and repent." Does that sound a little bit like Jeremiah's sermon to you? The same idea. You are a people who ought to know God, who ought to be following God, who don't need to be involved in wrong, who think you're okay but you're not. It's a very big lesson that Christians must learn, just as the Jews did. But I must understand that I've got to take it even a little bit more personally than that. It's not only a warning to Christians in general. It's a warning to me. That when I look at these lessons of Shiloh, and when I read Jeremiah saying, "Remember what went on there," there are things that I've got to come to terms with. And one of those is, whether Jew under the law of Moses, or Christian in the age of Christianity, I must not cling to the wrong ideology. I must not come up with my own plan, credit it to God, and then say, because I'm following it, I'm okay with God. I would say it's something kind of like this. We say, "Well, I'm Church of Christ. Church of Christ people go to heaven. I'm going to heaven." That is a false ideology. It is the idea, first of all, in such a denominational sense, that because I am aligned with a certain group of people, that's going to guarantee me a way to heaven. That is wrong. And I'll suggest to you this, that if we have that ideology, we are a whole lot like the Jews who believed they were going to heaven because they were Jews. What'd God say? He said, "Those who have the covenant ingrained, who follow the covenant because they love me, they are the ones who are going to be saved. I cannot cling to some creed, whether written or unwritten, and say that is my means of salvation. There is only one who is my means of salvation, and that is God. And when God tells me to do something, I do it because I love Him, and nothing else is going to work." Along that same line, I cannot cling to the idea that salvation is found outside of obedience to God. Listen to what the writer of Ecclesiastes says in chapter 12, verse 13. He says, "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments." There it is. Whether you lived under the time of the patriarchs, or in the days of the Jews in Israel, or whether you were a Gentile seeking to follow God in those days, or whether you're a Christian, this is it. Here is salvation. Fear God and obey Him. And that's what we must do, and allow nothing else to stand in our way. And just as we can cling to that wrong ideology, like them, we must be very careful that we are not clinging to ritual and equating ritual with spiritual. And if I may, let me illustrate it one more time, something like this. Righteous people go to church. I go to church. I am righteous. While we can see the fallacy of that argument so clearly, I believe it's one of the things that absolutely destroys our understanding of faith in God. Because all of a sudden, maybe not all of a sudden, maybe over many years, what we've done is we have come to associate an action as an indication that we're righteous. And because we complete that action, obviously then, we're righteous. That's not how it works. Because God expects so much more from us. Our attendance is important, but also His standards are important. Think about what the Apostle Paul says concerning this idea. As we look at the idea that that church attendance is important, consider what we find over in Galatians 3. He says, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against these things there is against such there is no law." That's spirituality. That's where we're saying to God, "I am going to be a part of your covenant because I want to be like you. A God of love and joy and peace and long-suffering and patience." All of these things. So, if I am going to be a Christian, I am putting on the qualities of God. But let's not ignore what comes before that. Because before that, the apostle says, "Now the works of the flesh are evident, sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. I warn you, as I warned you before, that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God." Now let me make a very simple but important point. There is no amount of church going that's going to save us from these things. If I think I can live like this, show up on Sunday morning, and everything's okay with the Lord, I had better learn the lesson of Shiloh. Because that's what they were doing. And I better learn the lesson of Jeremiah's Jerusalem, because that's what they were doing. And I better learn the lesson of Jesus' Jerusalem, because that's what they were doing. The idea that I can somehow pick out one thing and I can cling to it and I can say, "This is my lifeline of salvation," does not cut it. The covenant that God made with Abraham, the covenant God made with Israel, the covenant that God makes with us has all of this in common. We are His people, following Him because we love Him and obey Him. Therefore, we understand the warning that the apostle gives. Skipping on down in 2 Corinthians 4, talking about the wicked, he says, "In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." You see, spiritual blindness destroyed the people of Shiloh. Spiritual blindness destroyed the Jews of Jeremiah's day. Spiritual blindness destroyed the people of Jesus' day. You and I must not be blind to the truth. Let's don't deceive ourselves into thinking there is some kind of shortcut to salvation. Salvation is fearing God and keeping His commandments. And when I do that, I have learned the lesson of history, and I will be the kind of person that God desires for me to be.